Thank you, Rabbi. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So a little background. In 1886, Samuel Gompers started the first labor union in the United States. That was the AFL, the American Federation of Labor. The fact of the matter is that labor unions actually started in Europe and came over to the United States during the Industrial Revolution. Now, during the reason why unions basically started then, during the Industrial Revolution, is because at the time, the workers were they were underpaid, and the main reason why labor unions started was because of safety concerns. People were getting killed in the workforce, and that's really what initiated the labor union. The only thing else I'll add to this is that the basis for U.S. labor law is the 1935 NLRA, which is the National Labor Relations Act, which basically was the foundational statute for U.S. labor law. And it basically, the basic rights of private employees working for private employers, it was the basis for collective bargaining, the ability to strike if they want, and the ability to grieve working conditions if necessary. So that was basically, that is where all the actual law statutes come from in regards to collective bargaining between a union and the employer.
Also, I want to reiterate the thanks to everybody for coming. I'm humbled. Alan knows the material. I'm just I'm here for entertainment, I think. From a halachic perspective, just a quick background, and then we'll see as the questions come how they are applied. But there are two halachic principles which one has to keep in mind when it comes to matters related to labor law. So there is a relationship between the employer and the employee. It could be employers and employees. It doesn't make a difference as far as that. But they have responsibilities to one another. And the question is going to be what's going to guide and what's going to set the parameters or the nature of that, the character of that relationship. So that's really going to be defined by two things. Number one is anything which is contractual. Anything halacha says that kol tnai shebamamon kayim, any condition which two parties make in any sort of monetary context is going to be binding between those two parties, as long as they understood what they were entering into, so they could agree to essentially whatever they want, almost whatever they want. So that's going to be number one. And then number two is going to be what's called minagas sochrim. Minagas sochrim is a recognition that there are certain expectations of employment, or there are certain expectations of agreement between two parties, and it's considered to be so prevalent and so common, this particular aspect of the relationship, that even without stipulating explicitly that that's going to be true between this employer and this employee, if that's the way everybody in that industry conducts themselves, so that's something which is also going to be binding. It's assumed that the two parties agreed to that particular stipulation, that particular dimension of the relationship from the outset, even without having gone ahead and done so. So one example, the Gemara discusses when exactly a salaried employee, what their expected hours are. And they are essentially obligated to be there from sunrise until sunset, we'll say for simplicity, and it's based on psukim. And the Gemara says, well, what difference does it make? Why do we need to know what the Torah mandates is the work day when this is going to be based on common custom, whatever the work day expectation is, whether it's 9 to 5, 8 to 4, something along those lines for the rabbinate, it's 24/7, whatever the expectations are. But when do you need to know that? So the Gemara says that those things, the Torah mandate as far as employee-employee relationships, are only going to be relevant when a new town starts and there's no majority of residents from a particular town which are going to carry with them the old rules. So in the absence, if you start a new colony on Mars and you're taking a group from all over the globe, so then you may follow Torah law. But as soon as there's an expectation in industry, that becomes binding, and much of what we're going to discuss in terms of the labor law and bargaining agreements and stuff like that with unions are going to be based on this minagas sochrim principle, that what's commonly done is going to be binding.
Okay, so with that introduction, we'll start with the question. So the first question we wanted to discuss
was if one would want to terminate an employee, do you have to go through a progressive discipline? Do you have to first give a verbal warning, written suspension, termination, or could you just right from the get-go already begin with termination?
So in most collective bargaining agreements, there is a progressive discipline process. Usually it's verbal, written, suspension, termination. But there is a section in every contract which has dischargeable infractions or violations, which if you do the first time, you will be terminated and there's no progressive discipline. For instance, taking drugs is, you're gonna be terminated right away. Fighting, you're gonna be terminated right away. So in many of these CBAs, there's a listing of those, but other than that, there is usually a progressive discipline involved in regards to starting at verbal and ending at termination within a certain time period. Because what happens is that in most of the contracts, there is an expungement provision, which means if someone is so-called good for a year and they don't have any infractions, that infraction goes away, and then you start basically all over again. So
halacha differentiates between two different types of employees. When an employer and an employee make an agreement between them, and the a kinyan of sorts, but they make a binding agreement between the two of them, the two of them are expected to follow that through all the way to the end of the term of the agreement. If there's a contract, that would be to the end of the contract. If there's a particular job which is being done, it's to the end of that job. Halacha also recognizes that there are, what was it talking about, certain infractions which automatically the...
Dischargeable offenses.
Dischargeable offenses. So halacha also has such a thing as dischargeable offenses. If a teacher, for example, decides not to teach the students one day, so that since the teacher knows that the students, their chinuch, their education, relies on the teacher being there and giving them that education, and they know that if that's not done, you can never make up the time, you know, you can make up a class, but the time lost is time which is gone, so that's considered to be, you don't even need a warning as far as that's concerned, and the teacher, the rebbe, the mohr could go ahead and be dismissed. And there are similar types of, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't spell out all the infractions, but ones where it's very clear that this is an intolerable behavior, and it's one which causes the employer a loss. So halacha definitely recognizes that the person can be fired essentially on the spot for that type of thing. Beyond that, when there's within the contract to go ahead and break it. So generally, again, absent a collective bargaining agreement which would provide other guidelines, but generally it's assumed that unless there's going to be some sort of mekachtos, that there's some sort of fraud which was committed in the original agreement, that the agreement is going to carry all the way through to the end. And it's something which may be, in practical terms, difficult to enforce, but it's something which is in reality is an important part of halacha. I'll give one example, and then we'll go on to the next question. Again, it's something which requires deliberation by a rav, but it's not so uncommon that parents will decide that they're going to send their child, a young child, to a playgroup, to a backyard camp, to something, and they sign up for 4 weeks, for 6 weeks, for 8 weeks, whatever the period of time is, and after, you know, an hour, their kid is still crying, and they say, oh, my kid is not happy over here, I'm going to go bring them somewhere else. Once you started by sending them that first week, and the understanding was it's going to be an 8-week program, let's say, for a camp, or a 6-week program, it's not so simple that you as a parent could just pull your child and not pay the camp or the playgroup, whoever that is, for the remainder of the term, because once the agreement began, and then there was nothing which was fraudulent, there was nothing which indicates that the relationship cannot continue, so halacha recognizes those obligations as truly binding, and you may choose to send your child elsewhere, but you may be obligated to that first playgroup to continue paying whatever you agreed to pay, because they say, we're here, we're ready to carry out the rest of the contract. If you want to pull out, that's your choice, but that doesn't free you from your obligation.
Okay. During an employee investigation, employee requests a representative or advocate to be with him. Is it allowed?
Okay, so I won't go deep. You could elaborate this for a while. But there's a thing with Weingarten right. So basically what that right is that an employee during an investigation is allowed to ask for representation. Let's say they're part of the union. They're allowed to ask, I want someone in here to represent me just to make sure, you know, you ask proper questions, let's say, or... you're not railroading me. But the employee has to ask for it. The company does not have to ask the employee, oh, by the way, do you want representation? They have to ask for it. Once they ask for it, then we call a union steward. They're part of the investigation. And the it's during an investigation where you could ask for a representative. Once the determination of discipline has been completed and it's been determined, okay, we're going to give this person a one-day suspension, if they ask for representation, the answer is you don't need it. The investigation is over. It's only during the investigation.
So the as far as collective bargaining agreements, again, in terms of that, so if that's the agreement, if that's the understanding of the parties, obviously that that would be binding. In actual halacha itself, outside of basin, I'm not sure if there's a concept. This is what we would refer to in halacha terminology as a toein. A toein is sort of like a lawyer, but it's a person who's going to help a, in the context of a basin, is going to be a litigant. Over here would be somebody who may not be able to formulate their thoughts in such a coherent manner, may not be so skilled at expressing themselves succinctly and to the point in making sure that all of the essential arguments are going to be presented. And basin would certainly allow a person to go ahead and do so. From basin's perspective, it's often very helpful to have somebody who's a professional at that, because then we don't need to hear the story about what you ate for breakfast that day and what your aunt was feeling about and how all those other things which are extraneous to the story itself. So again, it helps everybody stay focused on what is the issue which is being discussed, as opposed to all of the background. So that would certainly be helpful. Whenever disagreements arise, it could be true by an employee or employer or any other type of agreement, we always try and encourage people. I certainly try and encourage people to make sure that it is as non-contentious as possible. There's an uncertainty. There's something about the relationship which needs to be discussed and what needs to be clarified. And if through having somebody else there, it will help the clarity. So hopefully everybody's on board, because ultimately that's what we want, to strengthen the relationship moving forward, rather than attacking, trying to undermine, trying to undercut or something like that, where the person is going to feel they're intimidated by what's going on. And then that certainly, halacha recognizes, we're going to come up to that in Sanhedrin soon, the halacha recognizes that imbalance is not something which is good in terms of developing the relationship, because it is seen as a symbiotic relationship, employer-employee, rather than one which is one having the power and the other having absolutely no power, which I imagine is part of what was behind the collective bargaining agreement, is to even the playing field
exactly.
A little bit.
Yeah. If someone uses a toy, isn't that not the litigant, the plaintiff testifying, someone else testifying as behalf? So how do you, based on yes, you're from the person, right? Not in a different language, not translated.
Right, so
wouldn't a toy kind of...
So there's an important distinction as far as that between a witness, the basin needing to hear the witnesses themselves directly, and then the litigant presenting their claims. So the restrictions we have about the language and understanding and making sure that's directed towards the basin and the witnesses in their testimony. The litigants aren't actually testifying to anything. They're just making statements which are there, but that's not really, it's not testimony per se. So if somebody will be able to help them, again, formulate the argument which they need to put together and to be able to sort of script it so that it'll be the most effective presentation as possible, so that's allowed. In many cases, it's encouraged, but it's allowed.
Following up on this question, when does this concept of the toein emerge in our thought? I don't recall it, I don't know, as being the Gemara concept. Is this something that came in with the Gay or Nino?
I can't tell you the exact the history of it when it came in.
But you do sense that the based in is always, I thought, been a domain of litigants and dayanim, not of Tony.
Right. I think it was probably just based on experience that people were just unable to go ahead and put forward the arguments properly.
But it is a very different to create a new institution like that within the courts. That's why.
I think it does. I don't recall now if it comes from the Gemara or it comes from the Rishon or the Gaon, but it says, "Psach picha le'ilem" is the pasuk which they quote. Open up the mouth for the mute.
Yeah.
So mute doesn't mean literally mute. It may mean contextually they're mute, either because they'd be intimidated by the Big Daddy Warbucks who's going to go ahead and try and negotiate with them, or again they're just not they're not an articulate person. And they need help, putting together that stuff. So in order to, again, the toein helps them present the strongest case. So what, if you have one person who is a negotiator and one who's not, so then, you know, that's, you know, the negotiator may win just by, let's say, debating skills rather than actual content to what they say, and then that doesn't produce a, you know, a fair outcome. So we're trying to, again, just even the playing field.
No, that's fair. Alan, and you, again, on this issue of the tone of the attorney, in your presentation, the indication is that the worker is getting his representation through the union. But we have cases, and it's easy to imagine cases, there's certainly been some in recent years, where in some way in which the union and the employer are more or less in agreement, and the employee may not get a fair shake unless he is independently represented. I mean, I can think of a case, for instance, where, say, the employee has some things like this, does or says something that would be in the current environment politically incorrect, in which case the elites who are running the union and the elites who are running the job are both after the attorney, the employer in that case. He needs to be independently represented. Is that possible under the Weingarten?
No, it has to be represented through the union. He pays union dues and through the union. Now, what happens is that there's a regulation where if the union walks away from the employee and just says, I don't want to represent you at all, the employee could sue the union for not representing him. But the outcome is that the employee can say to the union, listen, I want an arbitrator to hear the case. And they go through the steps of the grievance process and they say, you didn't represent me properly. Take the case to an arbitrator and let a third party make a decision in regards to. They have, yeah, exactly.
Alan, are there any restrictions on these Weingarten rights? For example, if the union is going to represent someone and the, let's say, the company needs people to work to get their stuff done, their products produced. So, are there any restrictions on the timeliness? You know, because the person who is representing a person could say, you know, I was just called to do this. I need 3 or 4 days in order to look at this, or I need this and I need that. And so, are there any restrictions, or is it just to whatever of the whatever is requested?
So, but let's say the employee has a complaint, right? So if the employee has a complaint, in every CBA, there's constraints in regards to, at the time of the incident, they have to bring it to the company or their supervisor and say, I have a grievance within a certain amount of time. Most contracts could be 3 days, it could be 3 working days, 7 working days, whatever it may be. And then for each step of the grievance process, there's usually 3 steps, it goes to different management people to hear the case, the complaint of the employee. That also has constraints in regards to the time limits. And then within a certain time limit, it has to go to arbitration. So an employee can't say, 6 months ago something happened to me and I want to bring that up, I want to bring that complaint to management. According to the CBA, you have to bring it to management's attention within a certain time frame.
I guess my question actually has to do with more the sort of the rights of the union and the representation. In other words, can the union say that, you know, we had requested to represent this person, we need this much time in order to review it, and meanwhile the company is short a worker, or, you know,
remember, the employee is still working during this process. The employee is still working, and the answer is you could have this meeting after working hours. It doesn't have to be during working hours. And if the union requests, hey, they request from the company information in order for them to represent the employee, the company has to give them the information they request most of the time, as long as it's not confidential information. And yeah, if they say, listen, we want 4 or 5 days to prepare for the grievance meeting, most companies let them do that.
Ellen, when you talk about progressive discipline, I'm assuming that has to be in the contract, right? Because Illinois employment at will.
Well, okay. In most contracts, you do have the progression, but even if you don't have the progression, you would then go to the corporate policy. If there's a corporate policy which regarding to discipline, that progression, we would just tell the employee, it's not in the contract, but you have to abide by every single corporate policy. And the policy says, here's the progression.
But some companies don't require that corporate policy.
Well, the thing is, in every contract, you need just cause discipline. There's certain things you have to meet in order to terminate an employee. There's 7 steps of just cause. If you don't go through those steps of just cause to terminate an employee and it goes to arbitration, the arbitrator will return the employee.
So this is for all collective bargaining agreements?
All collective bargaining agreements, yes.
Alan, one question. That's in Illinois, not other states. What you're stating now?
That's in every state.
It's an LR.
It's part of the National Labor Relations Act. If you fire someone and it's not just, you don't have a just cause, and you just terminate someone, of course it's not based on discrimination or anything, is that if it goes in front of an arbitrator, the arbitrator is going to, the first question they're going to ask is, okay, did you let the employee know the consequences? Was it the first time? And if your answer is, we just terminated on the first time, as long as it wasn't one of those major offense, dischargeable offenses, the arbitrator will usually return the employee back to work. Yeah.
What does the right to work state?
Right to work state. The only thing the right to work state means is that an employee does not have to join the union and pay union dues. It has nothing to do with anything else in regards to the contract or the relationship between the employee and the employer. That's the only thing a right to work state means. You don't have to join the union and pay union dues if you don't want to.
Does that mean they can get someone else to represent them if something does occur?
No, they have to treat, the union has to treat anyone who pays dues or doesn't pay dues the same exact way.
So they have to, isn't there an agency fee charged? Don't want to belong to the union. There's
at times there is an agency fee, which, you know, the funny thing about that is if the agency fee is it's the same dollar amount as the union dues.
That's correct.
Every job I've had in Illinois, employment that will stay, which means they can fire you. You can leave or they can fire you at any time.
Well, employment at will, right, it's no guy. Employment at will is for management personnel. As long as it's not discrimination, they could terminate you for any reason. But once you have a collective bargaining agreement between the company and the union, that you have to abide by whatever it says in the collective bargaining agreement, and you have to go through the process, whatever it states in the CBA.
Do either of you have any situations or stories that might be illuminating regarding when the halacha and the civil law may have been in such disagreement that there wasn't a straightforward path? Right?
Me? No, I don't.
Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about unions. And he talks about, as far as striking is concerned, whether laborers are allowed to strike. So he says specifically, he has a whole lumdisha thing why this is so, but he says that rebbeim and moras, even if they were unionized, they can't really strike. Because it has to do with the whole allowance that they have, that is in place, which permits them to take payment for teaching Torah. And then if they go ahead and they strike, so then it's in violation of that, and the whole thing, the whole structure sort of crumbles beneath them. So he says that should not really be something which is done. Outside of that, I'd have to think of other cases where there may have been an inconsistency.
And that's the same for federal employees are not allowed to strike either. They could have a grievance procedure if they have complaints in the workforce. But back with Reagan with the air traffic controllers, they said, we're going on strike. Reagan terminated them. Yeah. He's allowed to do that. They're not allowed to go on strike. Yeah.
If you have a contract with a religious organization and they fire you, do you have recourse to nothing other than going to the basement? Can you go to a legal court?
Generally, any grievance that two Jews have against one another should go to basement first. Check in with basement.
Basement was stacked against one of the individuals.
Nobody has to go to any particular basement. You could find the basin of your choice.
Basin
doesn't have any jurisdiction or any power until the two litigants empower them to mediate or arbitrate. Then he chooses another venue. He has to choose another venue.
The other venue could be a legal venue or no?
No, another basin venue.
Somewhere else.
Suppose he refuses to go to a basin.
The person refuses to comply with halacha, so then the other party may get an allowance to go to a secular court. But as far as first choice is concerned, it should be presented to basin. If you get summons, you have to respond to basin. You have to say yes to basin. You could say no, I'd like to go to a different venue, but you have to respond to basin. Basin is not should not be ignored. May not be ignored.
In other words, when you say you can respond, it means you could say I do not want to use this basin or I want to use another venue, as you put it.
Right.
Another venue could be what? Legal court or
no? Another basin. Another basin.
Okay, as we move on to the next question. So this may be more.
This is more
more towards Rabbi Schaffel than Al. So we'll have Rabbi Schaffel deal with this question. So during an investigation, can a Jewish witness who would be a fellow employee testify against another Jew if it may lead to termination of the Jewish employee?
So within Hilchos Lashon Hara, there's the halacha allows if an employer's interest is at risk because of an employee. So one is a Jew, it's not a violation of the halacha zaf lashon hara to give, again, with all of the parameters that the Chafetz Chaim puts on it, but there's no isser presenting honest factual information which would be helpful to the employer in order to make sure that his employee is not stealing from him, is not defrauding him, is not doing anything which is harmful to his interest. Because as much as one has to be concerned about the fellow employee, at the same time one is responsible for the employer to make sure that they're not throwing away money. So if one is called to go ahead and give that information, so again, assuming that one meets all of those criteria, so then one would do so. Lo samar al dam reecha is the pasuk which they cite. That one literally means you're not allowed to stand idly when you're brother's blood is flowing, but Chazal understand that to me, not only literally if somebody's dying and you walk away, but if somebody is losing money and you have information which would be helpful to them, then you're obligated to go ahead and provide that information. So in a situation like that, so you would you would do so. People want to know, again, it's important to know because we're in that society in the 21st century, is people often ask us about putting reviews online. I had a bad experience with this service provider, I had a bad experience with this product, whatever their kvetch is, they want to know, are they allowed to go ahead and post that in whatever review form that's going to be for others to read? And one has to be very careful when doing so, because, again, one of the prerequisites that the Chafetz Chaim says is it has to be something which is factual, and it has to be something which is, you can't exaggerate at all. And everybody knows that it's possible that you may have had a bad experience, but that doesn't mean that this service provider or this product is necessarily bad. And it becomes very difficult in presenting a review to draw that line between your personal experience, which was not good, and taking that the next step and saying, they're a terrible company, their products are, garbage. You look at reviews, five-star, 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 and then one guy, always there's one guy, comes along and says, one star, it's the worst thing I've ever seen in my lifetime. So how do you account for that? So in all likelihood, somebody's being biased and they're not presenting it completely factual and they're just not meeting the Chafetz Chaim's criteria. So when considering writing a review, it's always worthwhile to review the halachas of Lashon Hara to find out whether or not the review you're about to post is accurate and meets the criteria or not. Otherwise, it could be a violation of very serious prohibition.
Is there a difference between a Jewish company and a non-Jewish company? Or a Jewish product?
Yes. The prohibitions of Lashon Hara apply to Jews. So the restrictions may not don't really apply to non-Jews. That doesn't mean, again, that one should fabricate something, that one should be... it's always worthwhile, even when not in violation of an Isser, we were just talking about this in the Kola, even when it's not going to violate an Isser, it's always worthwhile for a person to train their mind to think, truthfully, honestly, without exaggeration, without bias, it would be possible. It's just helpful to your own thinking. It's going to be helpful for you emotionally because you're not going to get invested in things that you don't need to be invested in. So it's always a good idea anyways. It's good mitos, to character building, to go ahead and always to be mindful of that. But in a technical sense, it's not going to violate the Isser in the event that it's a non-Jewish company. If your double bacon cheeseburger just tasted rotten, you could go ahead and say it was a rotten double bacon cheeseburger. That would be fine.
On the other hand, you don't want to make Jewish people look like a bunch of guys.
Yeah, so make sure that your username, says, something else. Yeah. It's not being completely honest. You're misrepresenting yourself. All right, yeah. The internet is a dangerous place for many reasons.
If an employee, we'll just skip a couple questions just to, in the interest of time. If an employee needs to be off for his or her holiday, whether it's Jewish or non-Jewish, does the employee need to pay them or just give them the time off without pay?
Well, this is an interesting question because according to the Fair Labor Standards Act, FLSA, there is no federal mandate to give people off for any federal holiday. So now, in collective bargaining agreements, they're usually 10, 7, 8, whatever, federal holidays, which the employees are off and the company pays them. But according to the FLSA, you do not have to pay them for a holiday. Additionally, just to discuss it, is that according to the FLSA, you only get overtime after 40 hours in a week. So it does not say anything about if you work on a holiday, you get any kind of premium pay or Sunday. But in most collective bargaining agreements, through the years, is that you get premium pay if you work on a Saturday, you get premium pay if you work on a Sunday, double time, and you do get overtime if you work after 8 hours in any given day or 40 hours in a week. So, but to answer the question directly, holidays are usually paid for, federal holidays are usually in this collective bargaining agreement.
So it's a little hard for me to answer because as a rabbi, I work on Jewish holidays. So it's my employer does not give me off in those instances.
What?
Oh, maybe. Yeah, I wish. These types of things, as we said, this is one of those principles where the minhag sokrim, whatever is considered to be the common practice amongst employers and employees, is what's going to be be binding. In all matters, the guys from Daf Naomi know this, guys, people from Shul know this, Hamish agreements are generally not a wise thing to enter into. Whatever the agreement is, where things are not spoken out, they're not spelled out, and then people end up some point later on, there's a misunderstanding, and then there's a disagreement, and then you have, then you have to call Rabbi Shaffel, and you have to figure out how to resolve the matter. So to the degree possible to be upfront in terms of what the understanding is of the Jewish holidays, when on an Erev Shabbos you're going to get off, when on an Erev Yom Tov you're going to get off, do you get off for Tisha B'Av, you get off for Purim, you get off for Tu B'Shvat, you get off for Lag B'Av, whatever you want to get off, make sure that that's spelled out and it's clearly articulated beforehand. That way there won't be disagreement or confusion or anything later on.
Does that have to be written? Or can be
verbal? It doesn't have to be written. Verbal is enough, but then people forget. So it's always worthwhile to have something, some sort of record that you could point to. Again, an email is fine, if your text will stay for that long. But something like that where you could point to and say, look, here's what it says, and this was our agreement. Right, that's why it's not verbal, it's not a wise thing. Not a good thing.
Okay, let's say somebody has an impasse in negotiations. You have the contract between employer and employees. What is the next step?
Get out. This is an interesting question. Nothing in the law states that during contract negotiations with the union that I have to sit there and I have to agree to anything they request. The only thing the law says is that I have to bargain in good faith. So if I get a proposal of theirs and I don't read it and I throw it away in the garbage, that's not good faith. But if I read it and they say, I'm not interested in that, I could take every proposal of theirs and say, I'm not interested in any of it. Now, they could also do the same with my proposals. Now, when it comes to impasse, it's a very hard thing to get to. Basically, impasse is that you go through many hours of negotiations, usually it could be a year or two, and you get to a stalemate. Now, sometimes a judge has to go in front of a judge sometimes to define if you actually got to an impasse. But let's say you did. According to the law, the company is allowed to implement the last, best, and final offer they put on the table. And the union cannot do anything about it, except if there's no contract, they could strike. But the company is allowed, when you get to an impasse, a stalemate, the company is allowed to say, this is the last thing we put on the table, we're implementing everything, even if you don't agree to any of it, and then the union has to make a decision. They have to either say, you know, we'll go back to the table and we'll negotiate a deal, or they'll go on strike. But that's what happens. So the interesting part of it is that you would think that if you get to an impasse, neither party could implement anything. It's not true. The company has a right to implement it's called the LBFO, the last, best, and final offer.
What happens if you have a federal employee who can't strike? It means that the government can have the last say and then the federal employees have to do that.
Yeah, the federal employees cannot strike or they'll be terminated.
Not much of a balance.
Yes.
Well, the federal government want to make sure that all the services continue. You know, politically, it's a bad idea. It's not having, you know, some federal agency stop doing what they need to do to, you know, meet their constituents. So, what's that?
Sometimes it's a better idea.
Okay, maybe we'll just do one more question, then we'll just talk about, is there such a thing as a minimum wage? Well, not is there such a thing, there is such a thing, but does halacha / do we have to recognize a minimum wage?
Minimum wage, essentially no. Essentially, in a pure halachic sense, whatever is negotiated between the two parties. There is such a thing as there being a range of what, let's say, a babysitter is going to charge, or a babysitter is going to receive for babysitting. And if somebody comes in from, out of town, and they don't know the market, and you say, oh, here in Skokie, we pay the babysitters $1 an hour. So that would violate this. So even though they agree to it, but it violates this of onah. Onah is taking advantage of somebody else's ignorance in the context of some sort of business transaction. So in the context of employment, so it is possible to go ahead and underpay, or on the flip side, to overcharge. I charge $30 an hour for babysitting. I'll give up the rabbinate for that. So you go ahead and you could, there is that possibility, but short of those particular isurim, for the most part, whatever's going to be negotiated, that's the power that they have. Because again, the employer could really, outside of a collective bargaining agreement, the employer could let go of the employee because I don't want to pay. The employee could say, I'm not going to work anymore because that's not enough pay. So they could work it out. Usually the market, to a large degree, the market will take care of itself, other than when you get big government or big corporation or something where just the playing field is so uneven that you need something which is going to even it out. And that's where halacha will recognize it again in that principle of minaga sokrim, that if that's what's understood in the industry, that there's going to be this the standard, so then that that becomes binding for all those who enter into it.
They name their price. This is how much I charge an hour, and people are at will to hire or not. Is that considered or not if it's in excess of what anyone else? Let's say you have an interior decorator who has to charge $1,000 an hour.
So for that, there's different types of employees.
Yeah.
There's a schir yom, the person who's the hourly worker. There is the person who's the kabbalah and the person who's the contractor. Who's not really being paid for their time per se. They're being paid for the job, which you know, which is meant to be completed. So the halacha sees the type of relationship between an employer and a shechir yom, and the salaried employee, and the employer and the contractor, the independent contractor type of employee. Those are two different types of relationships that would require, you know, a little bit more of a shiur to elaborate on all the differences between them. But those are two different types of relationships as far as all sorts of, as far as firing, as far as quitting, as far as, you know, the ramifications of all of those things. So that, you know, that's pretty pretty long. Yes?
According to Kolocha, does an employer have to pay a woman the same salary as a man for equal work?
Yes and no. yeah, to be diplomatic about it, or no and yes, whichever. Yes, in terms of the halacha, doesn't see any reason to differentiate as far as salary for a woman or a man. So there's no reason that they shouldn't be paid the same thing. There's nothing which says automatically that a woman has to get the same as a man. There's nothing which says that a man has to get the same as a woman. It's just that what the market. The halacha doesn't differentiate in employees between a man and a woman. So usually it's going to be what the market will be.
So can you sue for
same thing for a Goy and a Jew? Same thing. All right. For employment agreements, there's no difference as far as that.
Do they have protected classes in halacha where you can sue for discrimination?
I don't think so.
Like man, woman, or Goy and a Jew, or something.
Other than Ona or something like that, or what? Yep. Yeah, I don't think so. That may be a difference in halacha and you know, business law. As far as discrimination is concerned, we had a case, I'm trying to remember now. I don't remember, something related to somebody who I think was felt that they were being discriminated against, and they had asked if I don't remember the details. Yeah.
I'm thinking of a case that you, if there would be a halacha would be against, if it would be against, let's say with the union, against the union. So I'm thinking that, like, for instance, last week in the business halacha, it's talking about a mashgiach who's supposed to come to a wedding, and the wedding was canceled, and he's suffering a loss because he didn't take any more jobs. He was preparing to come. So so you said, according to the halacha, it's an onus, and the caterer does not have to pay him. Now let's say that the mashgichim would have a union. And let's say if the union, according to the union, let's say bylaws, let's say the mashgiach would have to be paid. So we have a contradiction between the halacha and between the union. But the thing is, you're saying Hilchasad the Medina, you have to go off the, in that case, it wouldn't be against the halacha to go with the union because they're not arguing. When you have employment in the United States, if there's a union and they have their own laws, even though that goes against the halacha, you would probably not go according to the halacha.
Right,
that it would be. That would be considered going with the halacha, even though it's not the halacha.
Right, so I don't want this to be taken out of context. Somebody could cut and paste this and post it, so I'm going to get in big trouble. But for many areas of halacha and choshen mishpat, so the halacha is true, as we said, in the absence of a contract or in the absence of a minhag asochim, a common practice. So in something like this, if the mashgichim don't set something up to make sure that they're going to get paid even when the event is canceled, you know, whatever they've defined as last minute, so then it will revert back to what halacha is if there's no minhag asochim. If the mashgichim decide that we want to make sure that when we commit to do a job that we're going to get paid even if the job is canceled the last minute, so it's not a violation of halacha. The agreement which the two parties make is then going to overlap on the halacha. It's not a contradiction. It takes, you know, just precedence over the halacha. Halacha is a default in the absence of any other agreement. So if you have another agreement, so then that's fine. That's not a violation of halacha. It's not true, for example, like by Yerusha, by halachas of inheritances. So we're not going to allow the other secular law to override the halacha. But in employer-employee type relationships, so that's fine. It's not a violation of halacha at all.
Okay, we just want to thank Rabbi Schaffel and Al Sigmund for their time. Thank you all for coming, and we're going to going to bench.